Chapter 8, The Archetype of the Divine Healer. In this study of the parables, myths and symbols of the White Lotus Sutra, I have nowhere defined the terms parable, myth and symbol. This has been quite deliberate. It suits the nature of parables, myths and symbols to allow their nature to emerge not from any formal definition, but rather from concrete examples. We have not been trying to understand the parables, myths and symbols intellectually with our conscious minds. We have rather sought to experience them and allow them to speak to our hidden, even secret depths. Now we come to something similar, but not quite the same, an archetype, the archetype of the divine healer. And again, I will not try to define the term archetype. It has been popularized in recent decades through the work of Jung and his followers, but it is noticeable that in his writings about archetypes, Jung himself is chary of giving a formal, clear-cut definition of what the archetype is. Sometimes he seems to say one thing, and sometimes another. So, following in his footsteps, I'm not going to define either archetypes in general, or the archetype with which we are particularly concerned, the archetype of the divine healer. Instead, through different examples, we will attempt to conjure up, to call forth, different manifestations of this archetype, and even try to see them before our inner eyes. First of all, we are going to conjure up an archetype from ancient Egypt. Thoth is a very complex figure, like all the major Egyptian deities. He is a lunar divinity, associated with the moon rather than with the sun, and he is represented with a human body and a bird head, the head of the sacred Egyptian bird, the ibis, with a long curved bill. Thoth's ibis head is sometimes surmounted by a lunar crescent, and sometimes by a crescent with a lunar disc superimposed upon it, the full moon and the crescent moon together. In a sense, Thoth is the wisest and most intelligent of all the gods, and in a sense he is the best. He is the inventor of all arts and sciences, and indeed the originator of culture and civilization. He is especially the inventor of writing, in this case of hieroglyphic writing, and he is also the inventor of medicine. He is the divine healer of the Egyptian pantheon. In Egyptian mythology and legend, Thoth is especially associated with the goddess Isis and the gods Osiris and Horus, who constitute a well-known trinity. In some legends, Thoth appears as Osiris's vizier and scribe. Even after Osiris's tragic death at the hands of the forces of darkness, Thoth remained faithful to his memory, helping Isis to purify Osiris's dismembered body. When Horus, the infant son of Isis and Osiris, was stung by a great black scorpion, it was Thoth, the divine healer, who drove out the poison from the bite. Later on, Thoth is said to have cured Horus of a tumour and healed a wound inflicted on the god Set. The ancient Greeks considered Hermes, the messenger of the gods, to be the counterpart of Thoth in their own mythology, but Thoth is much more like the Greek divinity Apollo. Admittedly, Thoth is a lunar divinity, whereas Apollo is a solar divinity, but Apollo, like Thoth, is the patron of the arts and sciences, and of music and poetry in all their forms. And Apollo, too, is associated with the divine art of healing. In the case of Apollo, this is apparently one of the consequences of his being a solar divinity, because sunlight is necessary to health and healing. Although Apollo has these healing attributes, however, the real Greek god of healing is Asclepios, who significantly is the son of Apollo by a mortal maiden, and therefore a demigod. Asclepios is sometimes represented in the form of a serpent, but he is more usually depicted as a tall, well-built, middle-aged man with a noble, dignified appearance and an extremely wise and compassionate expression. Some of the images of Asclepios are amongst the most impressive, from a spiritual point of view, that have come down to us from classical antiquity. We know that the Gandharan image of the Buddha was modelled on the Greco-Roman Apollo, who was usually represented in the form of a beautiful young man in the prime of life. But perhaps Gandharan artists might have achieved even more impressive results if they had used the figure of Asclepios as a model. Note, Gandhara Buddhist art was developed in what is now northwest Pakistan and east Afghanistan between the 1st century BCE and the 7th century CE. The Gandhara region was a crossroads of cultural influences. During the reign of King Ashoka, 3rd century BCE, it was the scene of much Buddhist activity, and in the 1st century the region, now part of the Kushan Empire, maintained contacts with Rome, hence the Greco-Roman origin of the Gandhara style. In its interpretation of Buddhist legends, the Gandhara school incorporated many motifs and techniques from classical Roman art, although the basic iconography remained Indian. The Gandhara school represented the Buddha with a youthful Apollo-like face and dressed in garments like those seen on Roman imperial statues. In Greek legend, there are many stories of the miraculous cures wrought by Asclepios. It is even reported that his divine gift of healing was so great that he could not only restore the sick to health, but even bring the dead back to life. Not unnaturally, the king of the dead became angry because fewer and fewer people were arriving in his realm, and even those who arrived there were being rudely plucked back by Asclepios. So the king of the dead went to Zeus, the king of the gods, and complained bitterly that he was being deprived of his dues. And Zeus, who apparently had just one way of settling things, hurled a thunderbolt, and that was the end of Asclepios. Apollo, Asclepios's father, was furious and slew the Cyclops who had forged the thunderbolt with which Zeus had destroyed Asclepios. Zeus then punished Apollo, of course, and so it went on, just as it does on Earth amongst human beings. Asclepios was worshipped a good deal in ancient Greece. The important and powerful cult of this divine healer resulted in the many statues of him which have survived down to the present time. What is particularly interesting about the cult of Asclepios is that it was both a religion and also a system of therapeutics. The doctors in ancient Greece were priests of Asclepios and served at a number of celebrated sanctuaries, which were both centres of religious worship and centres of healing. These great sanctuaries were built outside towns on sites which were especially healthy, and there people used to go for treatment and worship, because the two were the same. Upon your arrival at a sanctuary as a patient, you would be ceremonially purified, so as to be free from sin, and then given a series of baths. You would be required to abstain completely from food, and you would offer up sacrifice to Asclepios. Then, on a night appointed by the priest physicians, you would sleep in the temple, perhaps with your head near the feet of the image of Asclepios. After all this preparation, and no doubt with great faith and expectation in your heart, and great hopes of a cure from disease, in the midst of your sleep you would have a dream, in which Asclepios himself would appear and give you some advice, either about your complaint or general advice. In the morning you would tell the dream to the attendant priests, and they would give treatment according to their interpretation of it. A few years ago I had the opportunity of visiting the most famous of all these old sanctuaries, the sanctuary at Epidaurus. As I walked around the archaeological site, which was strewn with votive tablets offered by people who had been cured of their diseases all these thousands of years ago, I found, very much to my surprise, that the atmosphere of the place was truly remarkable. There was something calm, peaceful, positive, and wholesome in the air. One could well imagine that a great sanctuary of healing had been established on that spot. The archetype of the divine healer also, of course, appears in Buddhism. In the Buddhist scriptures, both Pali and Sanskrit, the Buddha has a number of titles. In English, we almost invariably call him the Buddha, but in the original sources, there are many other ways in which the Buddha is addressed or referred to: the Tathagata, the Jinnah, Bhagavan, Lokajesta, and so on. Among these titles is Mahabhasaja. Maha means great, and Bhasaja is physician. So Mahabhasaja is the great physician. This is very significant and suggests something that we ought never to forget, that human beings are most of the time, if not all the time, psychologically and spiritually sick and in need of healing. The Buddha is the healer of the diseases of humanity, and his teaching, the Dharma, is the medicine that he gives humanity to swallow. That medicine sometimes tastes bitter, but it is certainly efficacious. A formula found in ancient Indian medical works analyzes sickness and health in fourfold terms: the disease, the causation of the disease, the state of being healthy, and the regimen leading to the state of good health. Now, the Four Noble Truths, those central teachings of Buddhism, are said by some scholars to be derived from this formula. The truth of suffering corresponds to the state of disease. The truth of the origin of suffering corresponds to the ideology of the disease. The truth of the cessation of suffering, nirvana, corresponds to the state of being cured, of being made whole. And the truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering corresponds to the regimen leading to a cure. The Buddha's role as spiritual healer is stressed in a number of his teachings and parables. There is the parable of the man wounded by the poisoned arrow, in which the Buddha appears as the physician wishing to pluck the arrow of suffering from the poisoned wound of humanity. On another occasion, the Buddha says quite tersely, even bluntly, "All worldlings are mad." The word used is pathujana, which is usually translated worldling, and refers to ordinary people, that is to say, those who have not yet become stream entrants. Apparently, the Buddha meant quite literally that everybody who is not at least a stream entrant is plain mad, not even just neurotic or just a little bit touched, but stark staring mad. This implies that the Buddha is not just a doctor, but the world's best mental doctor, and his teaching could perhaps be described as transcendental psychotherapy. As we have seen in considering Avalokiteshvara, the state of enlightenment has a number of different aspects: a wisdom aspect, a compassion aspect, a power aspect, a purity aspect, and so on. In the same way, enlightenment has its healing aspect. It is just like a great balm dropping down upon the wounds of humanity. This healing aspect is personified in the figure of Bhasajaraja, or Bhasajaguru, the king of healing, or teacher of healing, who appears sometimes as a bodhisattva and sometimes as a Buddha. As a Buddha, he is known as Vaidurya Prabha, which means azure radiance, or, translating very literally, the radiance of the semi-precious stone lapis lazuli. In Tibetan Buddhist art, this Buddha of healing is depicted more or less in the same way as Shakyamuni Buddha, but with a deep, brilliant blue complexion rather than a golden one. He wears the monastic robe like Shakyamuni, and in his hand he bears as his distinctive emblem an amlaki fruit. Translators of Sanskrit and Tibetan texts call this fruit an emblematic myrobalan. That's apparently its botanical name. I must confess that I have never come across a myrobalan, whether emblematic or otherwise, or, come to that, an amlaki fruit. But this particular fruit is renowned in Indian legend for its medicinal properties. So it is appropriate that it is the distinctive badge of this Buddha or Bodhisattva. In Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrasattva has 8 forms, known as the 8 Medicine Buddhas, a very popular set sometimes to be seen in Tibetan painted scrolls, with a main central figure and around him the 7 subsidiary forms. As in ancient Greece, there is in Tibet, or at least there was until very recently, a connection between religion and medicine, and many lamas were physicians. Near Lhasa, there were special medical monasteries where medical lamas received their training. Tibetan medicine is, in a sense, a continuation of the Indian system of medicine, which is called Ayurveda. Ayur is life, and Veda means science. So in India, medicine is traditionally called the science of life, not just the science of curing disease, but the science of how to live healthily, how to live physically in the best possible way. It calls to mind the system of treatment in the ancient days in China, when you paid your doctor when you were well and stopped paying him when you fell sick. Tibetan Buddhist medicine includes Chinese elements such as acupuncture. It also makes extensive use of consecrated pills of various kinds and of mantras. Not only in Tibet, but in many parts of the Buddhist world, the monks traditionally dabble, in many cases that is the only word, in medicine, sometimes successfully, sometimes, unfortunately, not so successfully. Usually, whether in Tibet or Sri Lanka, China or Burma, the treatment is a combination of herbal remedies, often very efficacious, and faith healing, or what we might call spiritual healing. In this respect, traditional Buddhist medicine of the East, in the East, especially in Tibet, is not unlike that of the priests of Asclepios in the ancient Western world. Vajrasattva, or Vajrasattva Guru, the king or guru of healing, appears as a Buddha, that is to say, in Buddha form, in a canonical text that bears his name. In this sutra, the Buddha relates to Ananda how ages and ages ago, Vajrasattva made 12 great vows, as a result of which he established in the East what is traditionally known as a pure land, where all beings who came to be born there would live free from disease. Vajrasattva appears in Bodhisattva form in the White Lotus Sutra in chapters 10, 12 and 22, or 23 in the Chinese version. In chapter 10, he takes no active part, but is simply the Bodhisattva through whom the Buddha Shakyamuni addresses the 80,000 great leaders of the assembly on the importance of preserving the White Lotus Sutra. In chapter 12, Vajrasattva is one of the 2 Bodhisattvas who assure the Buddha that after his parinirvana, they will propagate the White Lotus Sutra amongst all sentient beings in all directions of space. Having played a very minor role in these 2 chapters, in chapter 22, Vajrasattva moves to the centre of the stage. This chapter is not, strictly speaking, a part of the drama of cosmic enlightenment. Like the Avalokiteshvara chapter, it probably represents an incorporation into the sutra of independent, possibly later material. Traditionally, however, this chapter does form part of the sutra, and it is of interest for a number of reasons. In it, a certain Bodhisattva asks the Buddha about Vajrasattva, the king of healing, and the Buddha tells his story. He tells it at some length, so we will content ourselves with just a few details. In the remote past, ages and ages ago, Bhaskaracharya was the disciple of a Buddha called Radiance of the Sun and the Moon. This ancient Buddha preached the White Lotus Sutra, and Bhaskaracharya was greatly delighted by it. Overwhelmed with joy, he wanted to express his gratitude to Radiance of the Sun and the Moon in an extraordinary and unprecedented manner. He thought, "Everybody offers flowers, incense, flags, decorations, and money. What can I offer that is most precious, that is most dear, to which I am most attached?" And at that moment, in a flash of inspiration, he decided to sacrifice his own body. He did not act impulsively, but prepared himself by drinking gallons of scented oil until his whole body exuded fragrance. Soaking his robes in oil as well, he then set fire to himself by spontaneous combustion and burned like a lamp for 12,000 years in honour of the Buddha, until he eventually died. When he was reborn and grew up, the Buddha, Radiance of the Sun and the Moon, in whose honour he had burned himself, was still alive and still preaching. Bhaskaracharya became his chief disciple, and after the parinirvana of that Buddha, he superintended his cremation, attended to all the ceremonies, and erected for his relics 84,000 stupas. Having erected 84,000 stupas, most people would think that this was quite enough, even for a Buddha. But this particular bodhisattva still wanted to do something more. This time he set fire to his two arms, which burned for 72,000 years. This was the bodhisattva who is now Bhaskaracharya. According to this chapter, which is not universally accepted as canonical, the Buddha says that if you worship a stupa by burning a hand, a finger, or even a toe, that is more meritorious than offering all your possessions. This may seem a shocking note to strike, and may even sound rather un-Buddhistic. After all, the Buddha is supposed to have said in his very first discourse, "Avoid extremes. Don't inflict suffering on yourself. Don't practice either self-mortification or self-indulgence. Follow a middle path." If we take it at face value, it seems that in this chapter, the Buddha himself has strayed away, at least in precept, from the middle way. At the same time, the idea of offering oneself up as a sacrifice in this way may have a familiar ring. It is reminiscent of the cases of those Vietnamese monks who some years ago burned themselves in Vietnam. I was in India at the time, and I remember seeing pictures of these monks burning themselves. One particularly impressive colour picture depicted an old monk sitting cross-legged in the open street. His whole body was blazing. Apparently he had soaked himself in petrol. But he was just sitting there perfectly upright, with calm features, as though he was meditating. The old man left a letter behind, saying why he was doing this, and apparently carried it out completely self-possessed, calm and mindful. If you heard about this incident or others, there were seven altogether, six monks and a nun, you may have wondered why they set themselves on fire in this way. The reason was simple. They did it because they wanted to draw attention to the fact that in Vietnam there was no religious freedom for Buddhists. In those days there was a Roman Catholic regime in Vietnam, and Buddhism, though it was the religion of the majority of the people, was practically prohibited. I came to know quite a lot about the situation, because at the time I had staying with me in Kalimpong a number of Vietnamese monks. I had in fact become aware of the situation in Vietnam some time earlier, when one of the monks translated into Vietnamese one of my books, a short biography of Anagarika Dharmapala, the founder of the Mahabodhi Society and the reviver of Buddhism in modern India. The Vietnamese monk told me that when he went back to Vietnam in a few months' time, he would get it printed and published. When I saw him again about 6 months later, I naturally inquired about his translation of my book, and he said, I'm sorry to tell you it could not be published. I'm afraid the local Catholic bishop has prohibited it. We're not free in our own country. Buddhism is the traditional religion, but we're not free. Sometime later, the Buddhists in Saigon wanted to celebrate the Buddha's birthday, but they were refused permission by the Catholic authorities. They were not even given permission to fly the Buddhist flag, and that upset them, because only a few weeks earlier, the Cardinal Archbishop's birthday had been celebrated and the Vatican flag was flying everywhere. All the major educational institutions were Catholic, and admission required conversion to Catholicism. These monks felt that the only way they could protest against the systematic discouragement or even persecution of Buddhism by the regime was to take the dramatic action of sacrificing themselves. In this way, they would draw the attention of the whole world to the fact that Buddhism was suppressed and persecuted in Vietnam by the dominant Catholic minority. The ideological background, even the spiritual background, of their action was provided by this chapter of the White Lotus Sutra. Vietnamese Buddhism, though we don't hear much about it, is a singular and distinctive form of Buddhism. It combines two major Chinese forms of Buddhism, Chan, which we know better as Zen, and Pure Land Buddhism, which we know by the Japanese term Shin. And not only is the White Lotus Sutra highly honoured in Buddhist China and its cultural dependencies, including Korea, Japan and Vietnam, but in China and Vietnam, monks even go so far as to emulate, symbolically, the self-immolation of Bhaisajiraja. On the crowns of the shaven heads of Chinese and Vietnamese monks can be seen a number of scars which show where, at the time of their bodhisattva ordination, pellets of perfumed wax were placed on their heads and lit. During this procedure, mantras and prayers are chanted loudly, and the monks kneel with their crowns, as it were, on fire, while 5 or 7 pellets of wax burn down into the scalp. Some say that it is very painful, but they bear the pain, clenching their fists and trying to concentrate on the mantras. Some say that they do not feel anything at all. This ritual, from which every Vietnamese or Chinese monk and nun bears the scars, derives from this particular chapter of the White Lotus Sutra. When I was in India, I knew a Chinese monk who used to burn himself all the time. He lived at Kushinagara, the place of the Buddha's death. He spent all his time up a tree. He lived on a little platform, and people brought him food. Every few days, he would put a candle on his arm or on some other part of his body and light it, and let it burn down into the flesh. He was absolutely covered with burns. I'm not saying that this was very Buddhistic. In fact, the local Buddhists weren't very happy about what he was doing. They thought he was going to extremes. But he was very highly venerated by all the Hindus in the surrounding villages. They thought he was a really holy man, and they weren't so impressed by the other Buddhist monks who didn't burn themselves in this way. Un-Buddhistic as it may appear to be, the form that the protest of those Vietnamese monks took was not arbitrary, but can be understood against the background of the Chinese Buddhist tradition, which includes the White Lotus Sutra. And we can learn something from their action. It is a reminder to us that we should be prepared even to sacrifice our lives for the Dharma if necessary. It is very easy for us to forget this because, frankly, we have it so easy. In some countries today, it is very difficult to follow a religion, using the term religion just for the sake of convenience. People are driven underground and live in fear of a knock on the door. Here, however, we can follow anything we like. This religion, that religion, no religion, do as we please. And we do not always appreciate our good fortune. Not appreciating the rights that we enjoy, we become lazy, even indifferent. We are not always aware that under certain circumstances, we could be placed in a situation where we would have to choose between our religion and death. Perhaps this is the real meaning of this Bhāṣajyaraja chapter of the White Lotus Sutra, whether or not it is a later incorporation. It really asks whether we are prepared, if circumstances require it, even to give our lives for the sake of the spiritual principles that we believe in. It is not a question of throwing away our life, of making some grand, spectacular, theatrical gesture, but rather of being prepared to stick to our principles, even at the cost of life itself. To move from general considerations of the symbolism of healing to the parable of the good physician itself, this occurs in chapter 15 of the sutra, chapter 16 of the Chinese version, the chapter which constitutes the climax of the whole drama of cosmic enlightenment. To set the scene, what has just happened in the previous chapter is the appearance from the space below the earth, accompanied by a great trembling and quaking throughout the universe, of a great host of irreversible bodhisattvas. They greet the Buddha Shakyamuni as their teacher, and he greets them as his sons, his disciples. The whole assembly is amazed, and they murmur among themselves, "The Buddha gained enlightenment only 40 years ago. How could he possibly have trained such an incalculable host of universal bodhisattvas in such a short space of time? Not only that, but some of them belong to past ages and other world systems." They just cannot understand how all these irreversible bodhisattvas who have suddenly appeared can be the Buddha's, Shakyamuni's disciples. In reply to these doubts, the Buddha says that in fact he did not gain enlightenment just 40 years ago, but an incalculable number of millions of ages ago. This is his great revelation to his disciples, to the assembly, to humanity, of his eternal life, of the fact that in truth he transcends time. And with this revelation the sutra is lifted from the plane of time up into the plane of eternity. It is now not Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha speaking, but the Buddha principle. He says that he is eternally enlightened, and is teaching all the time, in many different forms, in many different world systems, appearing now as Dipankara, now as Shakyamuni, and so on. He is not really born, and does not really attain enlightenment, because enlightenment is not limited to the plane of time. He also said that he does not really die, but only appears to do so. It is just a physical body that disappears. The Buddha principle, the Buddha nature, does not disappear, but is eternally present, even though invisible. The physical body disappears after a certain length of time, not just because the Buddha has grown old, but for a definite reason, to encourage people. If he remained physically present all the time, the Buddha explains, people would not appreciate him, and therefore would not follow his teaching. It is to illustrate this point that he tells the parable of the good physician. Once upon a time, there was a good physician who was highly skilled in the art of healing and able to cure all sorts of diseases. He had many sons, 10 or 20 or even 100. One day the good physician went away to a distant country, and while he was away, his sons got into his dispensary and drank some of the medicines there, probably thinking that they would do them good. Those medicines happened to be poisonous, however, and having drunk them, the sons became delirious and fell to the ground. As they rolled on the ground in their delirium, their father returned. Not all of the sons had been equally affected by the poison. Some had lost their senses completely, but others were still able to recognize their father and explain to him what had happened. The physician at once went out among the fields and hills and gathered all sorts of herbs. These he pounded and mixed to prepare a medicine, which he gave to his sons to bring them out of their delirium. The sons, who were still sensible to some extent, took the antidote and gradually recovered, but those who had lost their senses refused to take it. The poison had entered so deeply into their systems that they were almost incoherent. But the physician managed to gather from their ravings that they were very glad to see him and wanted to be cured, but that they utterly refused to take any more medicine. Seeing that the situation was desperate, the physician decided that he had better play a trick. He said, "Look here, my boys, I'm very old, and the time of my death is at hand. I'm going to go away to a distant place, but I'll leave my medicine with you. If you take it, you'll surely get better, but that's up to you." And off he went, leaving his sons in their delirium. Some time later, a messenger came to the boys with the news that their father was dead. Believing this false message, which had of course been sent by the physician, who was alive and well, the sons were greatly distressed. "Now our father is dead, there is no hope of a cure," they lamented. Their grief was such that at last they came to their senses. Realizing that the medicine that their father had left for them was good, they drank it and were cured. When he heard of their recovery, their father at once came back to show them that he was alive and well after all. This is the parable of the good physician. The physician, of course, is the Buddha himself, and his 10 or 20 or 100 sons are sentient beings in general, and his disciples in particular. The good physician goes to a distant country, so that he is separated from his sons. This separation, like that of the son who goes away from his father in the myth of the return journey, and that of the drunken man who is separated from his friend in the parable of the drunkard and the jewel, represents the state of alienation from one's true nature. The delirium into which the sons are thrown in their father's absence represents the negative emotions and distorted views of reality by which we are overpowered. The fact that the sons become delirious through drinking their father's poisonous medicines suggests that, just as medicines do good if they are taken properly, so in the same way, there is nothing wrong with the emotions, nothing wrong with thought, nothing wrong with the physical body. It is the way they are misused that causes the trouble. It is even the same with the Dharma. The Buddha leaves the Dharma with us, as it were, having preached it, and the Dharma is meant to help us. But if we misuse it, it can do us harm. I remember meeting once on a retreat I was leading a woman who was delighted with one particular Buddhist teaching, the Anatman doctrine. That was what has converted her to Buddhism. There's no self, there's no soul, there's no I, no me, I am not. She went on and on in this way. But after being on retreat for a few days, she came to me rather thoughtfully and said, "I've just discovered something in my meditation. Now I know why I like the no-self doctrine. It's because I hate myself. I like to feel that I'm not there. I like to cancel myself out. It's just an expression of my self-hatred." As she discovered, she'd been making the wrong use of that particular teaching. Sometimes we ought perhaps to ask ourselves what it is in Buddhism that especially appeals to us. Is it all that glamorous ritual? All those lovely flowers on the shrine? Those beautiful images, brightly polished and shining with brasso? Is it all that meditation where we can sit in a lovely, peaceful atmosphere and glide away into some nice, comfortable, dreamy, womb-like state? Or is it all those books that we can read and all those interesting intellectual things we can find out about the 5 skandhas and the 84 different types of consciousness? Is that the sort of thing we like? Is that what Buddhism means to us? Or is it all that beautiful Buddhist art, all those lovely tankas which those poor dear lamas are still painting in India, all along the Himalayas? We have to ask ourselves what it is that we like and examine our motives. The herbal medicine which the physician makes for his sons when he discovers their condition is, of course, the Dharma. The parable says that those of the sons who are not completely delirious are persuaded to take the medicine. Those who have lost their senses, however, although they say they want to be cured, adamantly refuse to take the medicine. This is a very common situation. When I was in India, I used to meet lots of Hindus, and when a Hindu came to see me, far from making polite conversation about the weather, he would more often than not say, as though his whole heart was in it, "Swamiji, please tell me how I can become enlightened in this very life, right now if possible." Such a request is, of course, highly unlikely to be serious. It is simply good religious form to ask this sort of question. The petitioner would be horrified if you really gave him an answer and expected him to follow your advice. People ask for a teaching or a cure, but it is often the last thing they want. This reminds me of a story from Japan about a devout old woman who was a follower of the Pure Land School. When she died, she did not want to be born again in this dirty, wicked old world. She wanted to be reborn in a beautiful purple and gold lotus flower in the pure land of the Buddha of Infinite Light, and just sit there for ages upon ages listening to the Buddha preaching. She wanted to die quickly and be reborn in this paradise, so her prayers and meditations had a certain urgency. Every morning she used to go to the temple and prostrate herself in front of a great image of the Buddha of Infinite Light, saying, "O Lord Buddha, please take me quickly. Please take me away from this wicked world. I'm so fed up with it. I just want to die and be reborn in your pure land." There was a certain monk in that temple who noticed her behaviour. You could hardly help noticing it because she used to pray very loudly, and he decided to test out her fervent devotion. One day he stationed himself behind the image and waited for the old woman to come. Sure enough, she came in, bowed down, and prostrated herself, and cried, "O Buddha of Infinite Light, please take me, please take me to your pure land." And then a voice, booming out from behind the image, said, "I shall take you now." When she heard the Buddha's voice, as she thought it to be, the lady let out a shriek and fled, wailing, "Won't the Buddha let me have my little joke?" So, like the sons in the parable, people may say they want a cure, but they are not always ready to accept the remedy that is offered. Just as it was their grief at their father's supposed death that brought the sons to their senses, it often takes a painful experience to jolt us into awareness. The suggestion is that it is impossible for us to evolve through continual joy and happiness. There need not be pain and stress all the time, but there can be no serious development, no higher evolution, for the vast majority of people, without some suffering to spur them on. This is not to say, unfortunately, that there is no suffering without development. The main point of the parable of the Good Physician is quite simple. It says that we are most likely to develop when we realize that we are on our own. There is no God to save us, nor even any Buddha to help us. We are just potential individuals, and as such we can evolve only by our own efforts. By its very nature, the high evolution is an individual affair involving an individual effort. It is not that we should have no contact with others who are similarly striving. Such contact is rewarding, stimulating, and inspiring, but it is no substitute for our own effort. The biggest compliment that a father can pay his children, a compliment which some fathers, unfortunately, are not willing to pay, is to leave them alone to make their own mistakes and garner their own experience. In the same way, the biggest compliment that the Buddha pays humanity is to disappear. If we want to find him, we will have to rise to a higher level, to the level of eternity, on which he is always preaching this same White Lotus Sutra. And how do we rise up to that higher level? If we truly open ourselves to the influence of the parables, myths, and symbols of the White Lotus Sutra, and even allow ourselves to be carried away by them, we are sure to find ourselves in a different world. A world of timeless truth, a world of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We will witness a great drama, the drama of cosmic enlightenment, the drama which is going on all the time. Not only that, we ourselves are part of the drama. All living beings, in fact, are part of the drama. One day, remote as it may seem at present, we too shall be predicted by some divine voice to supreme enlightenment. We usually think that it is time to listen when somebody speaks, but the real time to listen is when somebody stops speaking. The real time to listen is when there is absolute silence. For if we listen to the silence long enough, it will not be an ordinary sound that we shall hear. We shall hear the voice of the Buddha, the voice of the eternal Buddha, and then we shall experience for ourselves the parables, myths, and symbols of the White Lotus Sutra.